All right, so have you ever been reading a case and thought, wait, how did that turn into first degree murder? Like, you see accidental death and then bam, serious conviction. Or what about those times when the prosecution, well, messes up with the evidence? I mean, does that just automatically mean the case gets tossed?
Yeah, it's tricky, right? Those are the kinds of things that, really make you think about the whole system, how facts and procedure and that burden of proof, how they all kind of come crashing together.
And that's actually what we're going to untangle today. We're looking at State v. Patterson, a North Carolina Supreme Court case from 1994.
Yeah.
You sent this one in, and it is a perfect example of how courts have to figure out intent, weigh different evidence, and decide if a procedural error is big enough to like overturn everything.
Oh yeah, Patterson. It's a textbook case, really. It highlights some core principles that every law student, honestly, everyone in law, needs to get.
For sure. So, quick overview for everyone listening. We've got Tanya Mitchell, who died from a shotgun wound to the head, close range. Her boyfriend, Reginald Patterson, claimed it was an accident. But the jury, they didn't buy it. They found him guilty of first-degree murder. Now, the appeal focused on two big questions. Did the state actually prove Patterson planned to kill her? That's premeditation, right? And was there a mistake the prosecution made in sharing evidence that was serious enough to just throw the whole conviction out?
It's like the defense was saying, hold on, you haven't shown you meant to do it. And by the way, you messed up the process. Those are big claims.
Huge. So what we're going to do today is break down these big legal ideas, premeditation, the harmless error doctrine, and how circumstantial evidence can be so powerful. We'll see how they all work in this case and, what it means for you as you're learning about the law. All right, let's jump into it. Let's set the scene. February 29th, 1992. That's the night Tanya Mitchell died.
Tragically, from a shotgun wound to the head, she and Patterson were living together at the time, and it happened at their residence. It took a few days, but she succumbed to the injury.
Now, right after this happens, Patterson drives to a store and tells Officer Johnny Manley, "I shot my girlfriend in the head. I think I killed her." He even tells him where it happened, their home, and that he chucked the gun into Thelma Lake. Like, just lays it all out.
And that's what's so interesting, right? That first statement, it's spontaneous. He's at the scene, admitting to firing the weapon, believing she's dead. This becomes really important later when his story changes.
Oh, totally. Because at the trial, it's a completely different story. He's saying the shooting was an accident. He tossed the shotgun on the bed, and it just somehow went off.
That difference between what he said at first and then at trial, the jury's going to notice that. It immediately makes you question, okay, what's the real story here?
Definitely. And the prosecution hammered that point home. So now let's talk about the physical evidence, because this is where things start to look bad for Patterson's accident claim.
Yeah, the expert testimony about the shotgun itself was, really damaging for the defense. They established that this particular shotgun, to fire it, you had to do a few things. It had to be cocked manually, and then you had to pull the trigger on purpose with like 3 to 4 pounds of pressure. So for everyone listening, think about it. This wasn't some hair trigger weapon that could go off easily. It directly contradicted what Patterson was saying about it just going off from being thrown on the bed.
It's not something that's going to fire from a
Yeah,
little bump.
right.
And then there's the wound itself. It was described as a large hole, no stray pellets, and nothing scattered.
Which, if you put that together with how the shotgun worked, it strongly suggests a shot fired from very close range. We're talking barrel practically touching her head. And get this. No other pellet marks anywhere in the room. So again, pointing to this very close range scenario.
So you've got a gun that needs to be intentionally fired, a wound that screams point blank, and no other evidence to support, a shot from further away.
It's not hard to see why the jury wasn't convinced by the accident story.
Nope, not at all.
The physical evidence just doesn't line up with Patterson's version. It's a classic example of how forensics can be like the truth teller in these cases.
So, okay, the accident claim's looking weak. But for first-degree murder, they had to prove premeditation that Patterson thought about killing Tanya Mitchell beforehand. But, and this is always the tricky part, how do you prove what someone was thinking?
Right, you can't just like read minds. So what we often have to rely on is what we call circumstantial evidence. It's the facts and circumstances surrounding the event. They don't directly prove intent, but they let the jury make a reasonable guess about the person's state of mind.
And in this case, a big piece of that puzzle was what happened earlier at the green store. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. Earlier that evening, there was an argument between Tanya Mitchell and Reginald Patterson at this local green store. Mitchell, in front of, get this, Patterson's brothers, calls him a sorry mother figure. Now, obviously, that's insulting, maybe embarrassing, could make someone angry. But, and this is crucial, the court said that legally this did not count as enough provocation to rule out premeditation.
So even if he was angry, embarrassed, it wasn't the kind of extreme thing that would make a reasonable person just snap and lose control, which is what would be needed to say there was no premeditation.
Exactly. The law in North Carolina and a lot of other places has a high bar for what counts as enough provocation to reduce a charge, like from first degree murder down to second degree or even manslaughter. Those involve killings in the heat of passion. Words, even bad ones, usually don't meet that bar.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because even though the insult itself wasn't enough to legally throw out premeditation, what the court really zoomed in on was what Patterson did after that argument. What were his actions?
Okay, so picture this. After the argument, Patterson follows Mitchell from the store back to their house, about a mile and a half away. He doesn't just walk in, though. He goes to his car, specifically gets the 20-gauge shotgun, and then goes inside. And when he enters the bedroom where Mitchell is packing her things, guess what? He's got the shotgun.
So the court is looking at this whole sequence.
Yeah.
Following her, getting the weapon, going into her room with it. They're putting it all together.
Right. And to them, this was showing he was acting with what they call a cool state of blood. Doesn't mean he was calm, but that even if he was mad before, he had time to cool down, think about it, and decide to kill her. It wasn't some out of control, spur of the moment thing.
So not a heat of the moment, passion driven act. It was a series of choices after that initial insult.
Exactly. And the court pointed to established legal principles, saying premeditation and deliberation, those key parts of first-degree murder, you can often figure those out from the circumstances. Things like, was there a lack of provocation? What did the defendant do before and after? Did they use a deadly weapon? Any history of problems between them? Patterson following her, getting the gun, going in the room with it. It all fit that pattern of premeditation.
Okay, so let's move to the procedural part of the case, because this is where it gets kind of technical. The defense also argued that the prosecution messed up. They didn't hand over all the evidence before the trial. What was that about?
So they argued that the state didn't give them Patterson's first statement to Officer Manley, the one where he admitted to shooting his girlfriend. And this is a big deal because legally, the prosecution has to share all potentially important information with the defense. It's about fairness, making sure there are no surprises.
And the North Carolina Supreme Court, they sided with the defense on that point, right? They agreed it was a violation.
Yes, they said very clearly that the state failing to give the defense that statement, that was a discovery violation, plain and simple. It's a breach of those rules of criminal procedure.
So they messed up. But then the conviction wasn't overturned. Why not? This is where we get to that harmless error idea, right?
Exactly. Just because there's a mistake in a trial doesn't mean everything gets thrown out. Things happen. It's not always perfect. The question is, did the error actually hurt the defendant? Did it stop them from having a fair chance to defend themselves? That's what the harmless error doctrine is all about.
So it's not enough to say, oops, we made a mistake. It has to be a mistake that really changed things. So how did the court decide that this specific mistake was harmless?
A few things. They pointed out that the defense during the trial was able to ask witnesses about that first statement. They weren't completely in the dark. In fact, it was the defense who brought it up when questioning Officer Manley. They were trying to use the part where Patterson mentioned throwing the gun in the lake to paint a picture of, like, panic, maybe a less intentional state of mind.
So the defense used the very statement that the prosecution forgot to give them. That's kind of a twist.
It is. So the appellate court's thinking was, well, the defense used it, they argued with it, so they weren't truly surprised. It didn't prevent them from building their case. The whole point of discovery is to avoid ambushes with surprise evidence. That didn't really happen here.
And do they think that statement should have been thrown out entirely, like not allowed as evidence?
No, the court said there was no reason to suppress the statement. They probably looked at how it was given and decided there was no force, no violation of Patterson's rights.
Now, there's one more thing the Supreme Court highlighted, the jury instructions. They seem to think those were really important in this whole harmless error analysis. Why is that?
They put a lot of weight on the fact that the judge, when talking to the jury, gave them all the right information, the important legal stuff, like what's reasonable doubt, what exactly is an accident, legally speaking, and the difference between the various homicide charges, all the things the jury needed to make their decision.
And how does that tie into the harmless error thing? Like, why did those instructions matter so much to the appellate court?
Basically, they said because the jury got all the correct info about the law, reasonable doubt, accidents, what it takes to prove first-degree murder versus something less serious. They could fairly look at all the evidence, even with that earlier mistake, and reach a just decision. Those instructions were like the guardrails, keeping them on track.
You said there was a specific phrase the judge used about reasonable doubt. What was it again?
Yeah, he said reasonable doubt is a sane, rational doubt, not a vain or imaginary one. It's a common way to put it, emphasizing that doubt has to be based on logic, common sense, based on the evidence, not just random thoughts or guesses.
Makes sense. So even with that mistake from the prosecution, the appellate court felt good about the jury's decision because they had the right legal guidance.
That's it. They trusted that the jury, with those good instructions, could carefully consider everything and reach a solid conclusion, one that was backed up by the law.
So, big picture time. For all our law student listeners out there, what are the big lessons from State v. Patterson? What should they be taking away from this?
Several things. First, it shows how strong circumstantial evidence can be, like what the defendant did before and after, the physical details of the crime. That can be super convincing, even if you don't have a confession or someone saying, I planned this.
Right. His actions after the argument at the store and the evidence about the shotgun, it all told a story that didn't match his accident claim.
Second, it teaches us about procedural errors. Yeah, discovery violations are serious, but like we saw here, they don't always mean the case gets thrown out. That harmless error doctrine, it reminds us that the courts look closely at whether the mistake actually harmed the defendant's case.
So it's not just about the mistake itself, it's about the impact. Did it really make the trial unfair?
Exactly. Like the court said, the purpose of discovery is to protect the defendant from unfair surprise. If there wasn't a real surprise, if it didn't stop them from preparing their defense, then it's less likely to be a big deal on appeal.
And lastly, Patterson shows how crucial those jury instructions are. It's all about giving the jury the right tools.
Absolutely. Giving the jury clear, accurate info about the law, like how to define reasonable doubt, what the crime actually is, any possible defenses, that's essential for a fair trial. And as we saw in Patterson, those instructions can even influence how a higher court views those procedural errors.
And there's that quote from the case, premeditation and deliberation must generally be inferred from circumstantial evidence. That sums it up, doesn't it?
It does. It shows that a lot of times, especially when figuring out someone's intent, we rely on the jury to look at all the facts, all the circumstances, and use logic and reason to reach a conclusion.
All right, so wrapping up our deep dive into State v. Patterson, we had a successful premeditation argument built on those compelling circumstances, his actions, the physical evidence. We saw a procedural error by the prosecution, but it was ultimately deemed harmless because it didn't really affect the fairness of the trial, especially with those good jury instructions.
Yep. This case is like a mini lesson in how those big legal ideas work in a real case, the burden of proof, proving intent, procedural fairness, and the power of the jury. All crucial stuff.
And for everyone listening, especially those of you in law school, think of this as a window into how those theoretical principles you're learning actually play out. See how the court went through each detail, each argument. It's a good challenge to put yourself in the shoes of both sides. The prosecutor trying to prove their case, the defense dealing with a tricky situation.
Totally. It's all about sharpening those critical thinking skills, really understanding how the law works in practice.
So one last thought to leave you with. The court really emphasized those jury instructions, right? How do you think the case might have gone differently if the judge had explained accident a little bit differently? And what about the harmless error doctrine in general? How does it balance making sure the rules are followed with ensuring finality in convictions? Something to ponder, maybe even look up some other cases. The more you dig into the law, the more fascinating it gets.
It really does. There's always more to learn, more to explore.
All right. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.
See you then.